I'm going to spread the news about the Florida boys. Shove it over. Hey, 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 you catch a line there. Oh, shack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a. Can't you move it? Hey, 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 can't you try?
Writer, folklorist, and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston grew up in the historic African-American town of Eatonville, Florida, and traveled around the state documenting folktales and folk songs like Shove It Over. Hurston's anthropological work in Florida, Haiti, and New Orleans informed both her books of nonfiction and her novels, as well as her theatrical works, articles, and essays. Since her death in 1960, the work of Zora Neale Hurston has enjoyed a resurgence in popularity. Several biographies of Hurston have been published, but until now, the later part of her life has been largely overlooked. Virginia Lynn Moylan is author of the book Zora Neale Hurston's Final Decade, published by the University Press of Florida. The book begins with an overview of Hurston's career as a celebrity of the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s and 30s.
Well, as a matter of fact, from about 1925 and 1945, she was the most widely acclaimed black writer since Phyllis Wheatley, the poet. When she appeared on the cover of Saturday Review of Literature in 1943 after winning the Ennis Field Wolf Book Award for Dust Tracks, it was actually the first time that a black author had been honored in such a way. By that time, she'd published two books on folklore, three novels, one autobiography, and she was awaiting the publication of her fourth novel, Seraph on the Suwannee. And at that time was when this horrible morals charges really took her down.
In 1948, while Zora Neale Hurston was living in Harlem, she was shocked when a policeman knocked on her door and arrested her for child molestation. The charges were false and Hurston's innocence proven, but the experience had a profound effect on her life and career. Virginia Lynn Moylan.
She had lived with a woman named Mamie Allen in 1947 in Harlem. She had rented a room from this woman. And although she wasn't there very often, she was in upper state New York, and she had gone to Honduras for a time. And fortunately, this showed on her passport, and it's what ultimately saved her from being falsely convicted. The landlady's son, Billy, told his mother that Zora and two other people, the janitor of the building and a woman who owned a candy store there in Harlem, had forced him to have sex with her in a basement, and that they met there every Saturday for, you know, a certain amount of time, and that she paid them money. It was just a horrible, terrible time in her life, and she was totally taken aback by this, probably hysterical. They hauled her off to jail, and she spent almost an entire day there until her Scribner & Sons, her publisher, sent an attorney, Lewis Waltman, to get her out of jail and try and calm her down and assure her that her passport would certainly, you know, show that she wasn't even in the country whenever this was supposed to have occurred. So fortunately, she was acquitted, but not before two newspapers published it. One of them was the New York Age, and in this particular article, the reporter at least interviewed Zora and got her side of it and present a balanced picture of what happened, although it was still humiliating. But the crowning blow was when the Baltimore-based African-American printed a salacious account of a story without even interviewing Hurston or bothering to find out the facts. And when that was published nationally, Hurston was almost driven to suicide. She wrote to her friend Carl Van Vechten and said, you know, even though I'm innocent, my innocence is powerless against the newspapers who care only about making money, and therefore I decided to end my life. Fortunately, that didn't happen.
After the horrific experience of fighting false charges of child molestation, Zora Neale Hurston returned to Florida in an attempt to get her life back together.
She first moved to Miami, and she lived on a boat called the Challenger. And she worked on a political campaign, a senatorial campaign with George Smathers. When that ended, she was contacted by a friend, Sarah Lee Creech, a Belgrade resident, who had seen black children play with white dolls and was struck by the contrast. And when she investigated it further, she spoke to one of her black friends, a black mother, who said that she couldn't find a black doll, an attractive black doll that wasn't a Pickaninny rag doll or Aunt Jemima kind of caricature that was insulting. And so Sarah Lee Creese decided that it was time to do something about that. She felt that was a cultural slight that needed to be corrected. So she set her mind on creating a black doll that was anatomically correct, as Hurston coined the phrase. And she found out that Hurston was living in Miami and contacted her and asked her to come up to Belgrade and talk to her about the doll. And she also wanted her to speak to an interracial council that had been created there. So Zora came up and spoke to the interracial council, which was comprised of 12 white and 12 black individuals who were trying to address the needs of the black and the migrant communities. And at that time, Creech introduced her idea for the doll and showed her pictures of the doll that she had in mind, some of the molds of the head. And, of course, Zora was thrilled with it.
Hurston was very impressed with the interracial council that Sarah Creech was involved in and introduced her to prominent African-American leaders such as Charles Johnson and Mary McLeod Bethune to help Creech market her African-American doll.
Sarah Creech was very conscientious about making sure that the doll that was to be designed represented and reflected the beauty of African-American children and their features. So she had castings completed by a renowned artist, and her name was Sheila Burlingame, and she sent copies of photographs that she had taken of Sheila Burlingame's models. And Hurston was so thrilled with them, she wrote her a letter giving her heartfelt praise. "Please allow me to say how pleased I am that you let me see pictures of the Negro dolls that you plan to put on the market. The thing that pleased me most was that you, a white girl, should have seen into our hearts so clearly and sought to meet our longing for understanding of us as we really are and not as some would have us, that you have not insulted us by a grotesque caricature of Negro children, but conceive something of real Negro beauty. Those dolls are adorable. They will surely meet a long-felt need among us. It is a magnificently constructive thing that you are doing for the whole of America as well as for Negro children."
Zora Neale Hurston lived in Ogalle, Florida in 1929. It was in Brevard County that year that Hurston wrote her collection of folklore, Mules and Men, filled an entire issue of the Journal of American Folklore with her research, and worked on theatrical pieces. In 1951, Hurston returned to the same Ogalle cottage where she had been so productive before. In a letter to Florida historian Jean Parker Waterbury, Zora Neale Hurston wrote, quote, "Somehow, this one spot on earth feels like home to me. I have always intended to come back here. That is why I'm doing so much to make a go of it," unquote. For the next 5 years, Zora Neale Hurston lived in Brevard County, working on a project that became her passion. It was a biography of Herod the Great that began as a play but became a novel. Virginia Lynn Moylan.
During the years that Hurston lived in Ogalle, she worked on several articles. For example, for the Saturday Evening Post, she wrote a story about Senator Taft, who was running for president during that time period, Robert Taft. And she also worked on a play that she hoped would be very successful on Herod the Great, who was the ruler of Judea from 40 BCE to about 4 BCE. She was fascinated with him. In fact, she thought that he was very misunderstood, that he had been unjustly branded as a murderer of babies. And she questioned, after her diligent research, she questioned whether or not that was even the case, and found that it was, to her mind, folklore. And a lot of modern scholars agree with her. There really is no other historical basis for the story of Herod ordering that all male childs be murdered so that Christ could be killed in the net. And she wanted to rectify that mistake.
In 1952, while living in Brevard County, Zora Neale Hurston also covered the sensational trial of a black woman named Ruby McCollum, who murdered her white lover, Dr. Leroy Adams.
The McCollum trial was a fascinating trial because it had all the elements of a best-selling novel. It had forbidden love and deep betrayal, greed, political corruption, bizarre revelations, and Hurston was attracted to it for that reason. She also said that she had a genuine fascination with the dramatics of the case and the play of human emotions. Ruby McCollum was a 37-year-old mother of four who was married to Belita Sam, and they were the wealthiest black couple in town. They had made a fortune running a wildly popular and profitable, although illegal, numbers game called Belita, a forerunner to today's lotto. The murder victim, Dr. Clifford Leroy Adams, was a 44-year-old husband and father, and he was the most popular doctor in Suwannee County, and he was also a newly elected state legislator. So his death definitely, you know, caused quite a stir in the community.
Sora Neale Hurston was no stranger to controversy. In 1954, she wrote a letter published in the Orlando Sentinel that argued against the landmark Supreme Court decision in Brown versus the Board of Education, which led to the desegregation of schools. Hurston feared that the court-ordered integration would have a negative impact by destroying strong African-American schools and taking black students from caring learning environments to hostile ones. Moylan says that in many cases, Hurston's fears were correct.
The students, black students, were forced into schools where there was a hostile environment, where students and administrators and teachers did not want them to be. And so not only do they face hostility, but they were steered into what we call the track system, where they went to classes with where funds were not readily available for special equipment, where the learning expectation was very low, whereas the white students were steered into higher classes of, you know, of higher challenge, with, you know, funding available for all the materials that they needed. So it was, they didn't really desegregate. So their needs, educational needs, were definitely not being met. And this was what she was afraid would happen.
Unable to buy the O'Galley cottage that she loved so much, in 1956, Zora Neale Hurston moved to an apartment in Cocoa Beach and then a trailer on Merritt Island. In 1957, she was fired from her job as a librarian at Patrick Air Force Base because she was too well-educated for the job. Hurston took a job at the Chronicle in Fort Pierce.
Whenever Hurston moved to Fort Pierce, she had suffered neglect. She had suffered critical neglect. She had suffered physically. She was still, you know, keenly upset over what had happened to her with these false charges, and she felt betrayed by her race. She was looking for a peaceful refuge where she could find love and friendship and work and employment. And she found all those things in Fort Pierce. The community appreciated who she was, and they did everything they could to make her life comfortable and happy. C.E. Bolin, who was the editor of a newspaper there in Fort Pierce, the Fort Pierce Chronicle, gave Hurston a job writing a weekly column. She was also befriended by a physician, C.C. Benton, who provided her a nice little cottage free of cost. He admired her so much that he would come by, close his medical office early, and he would come by and make sure that she had food in her refrigerator, that she had everything that she needed as far as medical care. And he would have long conversations with her. He was fascinated by her intellect and admired her very, very deeply. And in fact, he said they would get into conversations that were so deep, sometimes she lost me.
Zora Neale Hurston died in 1960. Writer Alice Walker had a marker placed on Hurston's grave that calls her a genius of the South. Virginia Lynn Moylan is author of the book Zora Neale Hurston's Final Decade, published by the University Press of Florida.
The captain got a pistol, he tried to play bad, but I'm gonna take it if it make me mad. Shove it over. Hey, hey, can't you lie there? I shack a like a like a like a like a like a can't you move it? Hey, 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 can't you try?